are listening to 99.1 WQRT LP Indianapolis, and this is Create Here. Produced by artists and curators from Big Car Collaborative, Create Here is your place to listen to conversations with people making intriguing, innovative, and impactful things happen on the cultural front in Indianapolis, Indiana, and beyond. Find out more and access additional episodes at WQRT.org.
Hello and welcome to Create Here. I'm Mary Goodwin. I'm the co-founder and director of Aurora Photo Center, and we are joined today by Eli Craven, who is currently an artist in residence here in Indianapolis. Eli is based in Lafayette, Indiana. He received a BFA from Boise State University in 2011 and an MFA from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign in 2016. His research resides in the critical investigation of the image and its relationship to ideologies of sexuality, desire, and death. He is currently also an assistant professor of photography at Purdue University. Welcome, Eli. Thanks for being here.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much.
Yes. And before we go too much further, I want to say thank you to the folks here at Tube Factory, Big Car, and Listen Here, and especially Sean Jones for joining us in the studio today. Thanks for making this interview possible. Yeah.
Yeah. Excellent.
Indeed. So you are currently an artist in residence here in Indianapolis. You are participating in the Aurora Photo Center Heron Residency. And that's something that we've been doing for a year now. You're the second resident for that particular residency. Thanks to the people at Heron for helping us put that together and make that possible. Yeah. So... you've been here for the past 2 weeks working, and yes. We'd like to talk a little bit more about that later, but, you know, I'd like to start off our talk today by asking a question I always think is interesting about, you know, when you're learning about an artist is, you know, how did you get into the arts, and specifically, you know, what led you to photography? Was there somebody in your family who kind of paved the way for you with that?
No, not necessarily paved the way. In fact, it was more like a diversion or a roadblock in a sense, because my father is a painter. He's a landscape painter, primarily watercolor, but some oils, but all kind of like American West photorealistic landscapes. And so growing up, I always thought that's what art was. Art was painting. It was a very limited view. And I was slightly deterred just as a, you know, as I became a teenager, I just obviously wanted to rebel. And I wasn't interested in doing what my father did. And I wasn't interested in doing what my mother does. So I wanted to pave my own way and make my own thing. And so I was a little lost for a while, but after high school is when I actually got into photography, but I didn't think of it as an art form, so to speak. I was looking at it as like a career option, like kind of. I was thinking of being a photojournalist. I was also into
a photojournalist.
Yeah, I don't know. Well, I don't know what I was thinking. I was quite naive when it came to photography. I didn't quite understand how the business worked. But I wasn't in college, and I just thought I'd try to teach myself how to be a photographer and take pictures. And so I started looking at street photographers.
Which ones?
Obviously, very early, I was looking at Henri Cartier-Bresson and Robert Frank. Mm-hmm. And then quickly looking at those colorists, William Eggleston and Stephen Shore, and kind of copying them, so to speak, walking around and just trying to take pictures. And then... really ignorantly, not really even really understanding what I'm doing or how, what I would even do with it. I'm like 18 years old at this time, and I don't even think I understand that people have exhibitions or what an exhibition is.
So you were really working intuitively. Yeah.
Yes. And as I got pretty good at it, people started to ask me to take pictures for them. And I quickly found that I really disliked being the commissioned photographer. The anxiety that came with producing for someone with an expectation really turned me off from being a photographer. And so when I decided to go to college to get a degree, because I felt like I was supposed to, I immediately started studying English literature, creative writing, and I was going to go into journalism from that approach as a writer. And I also thought in the back of my mind, you know, I have some photo skills. Maybe that could aid me as a journalist in the future. Who knows? I don't know. And so I ended up taking a class at Boise State University. And it was a darkroom class. It was like an intro to darkroom photography class. And I thought it would just be a fun elective to get out of the way as I went off on my writing career. And it totally turned my world upside down, because then I was introduced to the photograph or photography in conversation with fine arts, conceptual photography or conceptual art in general. It was the conversation was immediate in that class, and it just flipped a switch, and I was hooked at that point.
It wasn't the darkroom necessarily that did it. It wasn't the magic of the darkroom.
Well, I mean, it isn't. I mean, the darkroom is magical. I think witnessing the development of film, the development of a print, and watching your first print come out in the chemistry, that was pretty exciting. But I think the thing that really excited me was that, you know, we immediately in our first critiques, we were talking about our content and the symbolism within the frame, or the meaning that comes with every choice you make. And seeing it as such a communication tool, I thought was what really hooked me. I wanted to explore that further and explore conceptual art further.
Even at that early stage, were you working with the human body? That's something that we see a lot in your practice. When did that start? Was it there from the beginning?
I think so. Even those early days before I went to college and I was just trying to teach myself, it was street photography that I was interested in, and it was capturing the human form in some way. But I think I was just always interested in just some sort of representation of the human body in some way. I don't know. And then it quickly turned into that continually as I progressed through my BFA program. I was always taking pictures of friends, family, people on the streets. It was the figure was always in the work. Yeah.
Yeah, the source of the imagery that you work with today. I mean, like you said in the early days that you were making your own images, but my sense is that the work that you've been doing for like maybe the past 5-7 years has been more archival in nature. I mean, sampling things from the archive, from the vernacular archive.
Yeah, That sort of started towards the tail end of my BFA program, and then definitely into my graduate studies at University of Illinois. I think, you know, going all the way back to that first darkroom class, and then I also took more darkroom classes. I stayed there and I did some color darkroom courses. I was just really attracted to the materiality of photography, and I liked looking at the image, but I loved handling the print and manipulating the print and playing with that. And there were courses that I did in my undergrad, and then there was also just a really deep exploration of how to transform that thing through obstruction or alteration in some way. And that became a deep interest for many years. And so I would kind of rotate between taking my own photographs, but then also considering how then they would be completed or manipulated, into just looking through the vernacular archive or searching and building an archive of sources that I didn't necessarily create myself. And which then also just brings in this whole other layer of meaning, you know, where is that source from and what does it mean to borrow from it and then transform it?
Where do you look for your imagery? I mean, is it everywhere? Is it in flea markets? Is it in vintage stores? Is it found on the bus when somebody leaves a magazine on the seat? Or
I've never picked one up off the bus seat, but Early on, it was a lot of thrift stores and estate sales and antique shops, flea markets, all that kind of stuff. I was really attracted to, especially the really old photography, kind of wondering about that history and that time. And then as I continued, I would collect vintage magazines and vintage books from these places. And then kind of leading up to where I'm currently at in the residency too, I would occasionally happen upon like an entire family archive, and that would be at an estate sale where someone had passed and no one in the family was interested in keeping this entire like case or filing cabinet or box full of their family's history. And I was able to acquire it. And then you have this whole other insight, which is child pictures, school pictures, family pictures, but also they're one of the archives I'm using in the residency. It's an anonymous family collection, but there was a photographer in the family, a pretty dedicated large format, medium format photographer. And so there's some beautiful photographs in there, but it's all entirely anonymous. And then also very personal, because it's not just the snapshot that I'm collecting. It's also these really beautiful, intimate portraits of people within the family. So,
yeah, in your work, just going back to the early days that you were talking about, where first getting into the dark room, that even at that point you were sort of subverting this idea of the truth of an image by taking them apart and reassembling them. It sounds like collage and assemblage has been a part of your work even from like the earliest days of your practice. Is that right?
Yeah, I fell into collage when I had finished my undergrad. While I was interested in, like I said, the materiality of my prints, I was working in the darkroom up until I finished that degree. And then you have that shock of being kicked out of the school, not kicked out of the school, but you know, you get your degree and then you have to move on. And when you move on as a studio artist, then you know, there's that negotiation of what does my practice look like now? Can I afford the same facilities I was using at this institution, or can I not? Then how do I proceed? And I could not afford any of those facilities. I could not afford to work in a dark room anymore. And so for quite some time, I didn't have a studio space at all, which led me to just working at the kitchen table and with an increasing amount of found imagery, because that's what I had access to, as I wasn't shooting as much. I didn't have a studio. And so for a few years, I did collage very heavily, almost straight collage and no other photography, until I could get access to another space to kind of bring the two together.
In your work of the past couple of years, and I'm thinking about the Pocket Wisdom and many of the series that work with the human figure, you've been bringing in other materials besides the photographic image, you know, besides the paper. You've brought in beautiful walnut into these constructed pieces that you do. And for folks who are looking at his work on the website, I believe they can see that most recent work under the link there that's called Recent Work. Mm-hmm. You've incorporated wood. You've had some work that also incorporates a screen. And very often these materials, they work to sort of, well, first they split the image, but they obscure some of the information from the image very often. Could you talk a little bit about the entry of these other materials into your work? When did that start? How did it start? And is it linked to like a desire to explore one of these major themes about, you know, sexuality and desire and death?
You know, I started using some of these additional materials when I was looking. I was looking for photography at thrift stores or, you know, estate sales, stuff like that. And I would just obviously find other objects or other things that kind of carried some meaning in that. So it was the salvaging of these discarded items that then led me to using this material. It probably started first with the screens, which the screen that it's like a perforated aluminum sheet that I use a lot. And it's usually found at a hardware store, and it's used as like a venting or a grate in a vent or like a radiator vent or a radiator cover. And I noticed that it does have the same pattern often as what you'd see in a confessional screen. In like the Catholic Church, when you go into confession and sit in one box, and then the screen separates you from the priest. And
yeah, it's a pattern that immediately it looks familiar, but you're like, where does that come from? Yeah. I thought of the moiré pattern to me, it looks a little bit more like a moiré pattern that you see when printed material, when the ink hits the paper.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do use some perforated screens that are almost smaller circular perforations, and that looks a lot like that, or like a Bende dot. Mm-hmm. And then, but the one, it's like the cross-like shape, and I felt like I was using it as a means to kind of, sort of imply that there is some kind of conversation happening, but it's also a curiosity about what are the secrets behind this photograph? What are the secrets behind this portrait? What is the conversation that could be had? But it's also this complicated conversation that is then obstructed and unheard. And so, yeah, I used those screens were one thing. And then I was also using these mirrored panels. I would, when I started building my own frames and constructing them and shaping them differently, I would build it into, a corner and then place a mirrored panel in there. And that came about when I was reading about, it's a theory called naive optics. And it has to do with our mind's interpretation of looking at ourselves in the mirror and assuming that things will move one way or the other, and our brain interprets it incorrectly. And so I had thought about that for a long time because I do that myself. You know, when you get in the mirror and you move the wrong way or sure, just things yeah. don't look correct. And I was thinking about the mirrored reflection as being this sort of incorrect interpretation of reality, and wanted to place that into these images or find images that had this really kind of unclear interpretation that could be then further disrupted by a doubling or a replication in a corner.
They are really beautiful objects, you know, when you see them in person. That particular series of work with the mirrors is just, it's gorgeous. Yeah.
Oh, thank you.
So that particular series that's been exhibited pretty widely, I believe.
Pieces of it have been, yes. I mean, there was some work at the South Bend Museum of Art up in South Bend, Indiana recently, and at Filter Space in Chicago. And then I had a show last summer at the Telluride's Art Center in Telluride, Colorado, of all that work. And so, and it's still a work in progress. I'm still kind of working through these constructions and using those mirrored panels. So it's going to keep growing, I think.
Yeah, in the mirrored panel work, and especially in the work that incorporates the walnut, in those pieces, very often I feel like the material, either the mirror or the wood, really introduces like a tension into the image. Very often, to me, but like when that outside material meets the image, it feels like a cut. I mean, it feels like there's immediate energy there. And I wondered, how does that, is that something that you're conscious of when you are sort of making these constructions? You know, like very often, like the material, it literally pierces a sensitive part of the body, you know, like right across the wrist or, you know, someplace where, I don't know, there's a very strong, immediate visceral reaction when you see that meeting of the materials over a sensitive part of the body like that.
Yeah, or like right across the face.
Mm-hmm.
I That's definitely not an intentional thing. I do understand that interpretation. And when I've heard many people see the work feel like it's like a slice or something, or like a body's being cut at a certain point. I tend to look at it as this just sort of obscured continuation. And so I see this form continuing and then just becoming this almost unrecognizable or amorphous distorted form. And that's what's always kind of on my mind as I build these and place the panels. And so, but I'm okay with that interpretation. I understand that interpretation.
Going back to this idea of collage and, you know, bringing things together, bringing like desperate pieces together or disparate pieces together and creating something new out of, you know, the assembled parts. In the intro and in your artist statement, you talk about bringing that technique and that conceptual work to themes of sexuality, especially. I'd like to talk a little bit about that, you know, like as you come to that work and you're making these images that definitely have a very sensual feeling to them, how do you approach that? Or is there a particular goal or statement, or is it purely visual where you're more interested, or is it more driven by the visual where you're more interested in making that new thing something gorgeous and sensual, or maybe all of the above?
Well, I think it depends on the project. With a very early collage project, Screen Lovers, I had a very clear motive with the reason why I wanted to move those images around and cut them and put them back together. And that had to do with looking at these existing images of what I felt were unrealistic representations of sex, sexuality, love, intimacy. And so I wanted to transform those and then even in some repurpose them to just distort them, but then also to play with the idea of what does sex really look like, not in the movies, you know?
Well, for those who are not familiar with the Screen Lovers series, mm-hmm. could you just give a little bit of background about that?
Yeah, it comes from a book of the same title, and it's a book that's just a book full of movie stills. Mm-hmm. And the movie stills were meant to have a look inside Hollywood's lovers of throughout history. So they were all romantic, sexually charged film stills. But as I flipped through the book, you'd see that I think in zero of them is there really actually love making happening. It's always that moment.
Well, sure, there's always Hollywood.
Yeah, there's a moment where their eyes are closed and they have not made connection yet. Mm-hmm. And it's almost entirely white and male to female, like traditional cis love. And so when I started making that project, it was really about just kind of distorting everything I was seeing in that book through the collages. And then by the end of the project, I was borrowing images from other movies and other sources to kind of like put two men together, to put two women together, to really kind of alter this representation that I wasn't seeing in the book. And so that's kind of a breakdown of that project. And then the more recent work, that project is probably almost 10 years old now. Mm-hmm. And the more recent work, I'm not looking at things that were intended to be charged with sexuality or with eroticism or desire at all. I'm looking at first aid manuals and instruction manuals on like human care, and seeing these very intimate moments depicted, but they're moments intended for safety or for resuscitation or for medical care. And I'm playing with them in a way to kind of cover or distort and then see what kind of like erotic or sexual look comes out of them when they're transformed in just a small way.
Yeah, it is surprising how you can get to that place from that particular source imagery, you know, from the first aid manuals. Again, subverting the intended purpose of the imagery and getting to this idea of, you know, the truth of an image and questioning that and, you know, taking it apart and putting it together into something more truthful and more beautiful. Yeah, definitely. I see that. Looking at your work recently and in the past, the beauty of it, the sensuality of it, I do definitely see the way that you address sexuality in your imagery. But you've also talked about your imagery going into the idea of death and exploring death, you know, and that's something, you know, from a historical perspective, photography's always had an interesting relationship with death. But how does that theme like surface in your work? Where do you see that taking place?
Well, I mean, it's something I think about all the time is death. But I think it's come up in a few bodies of work over the years. One series called PS and one series called PPS that are both on the website where mm-hmm. I was thinking like very closely about death. And it really was kind of starting when I was starting to think about where these family archives were coming into my hands. And most often, when there was a death in someone's family.
Right. Oh, yeah.
And so I was thinking about two things. I was thinking about how time passes and then this image is recorded forever. And like it's the death of that moment, but it's also that person is, in most cases when I collect these things, the people depicted have passed on, have moved on, or I have no way of knowing. But the other aspect of it is not just that the people in those images have passed, but also it's sort of like the death of that object's life in a way. Like, I don't know how to explain it other than somebody has to assign it some value, and the value should be that, you know, this man or woman or this couple has then passed. Wouldn't maybe their grandchildren or their kids or somebody want to hang on to these mementos, these visual likenesses of their family history? And it's being discarded as a valueless object. And so,
which is just like total blasphemy for photographers.
We
just can't understand how that happens. But yeah. Especially in this now predominantly digital age, that actual analog, the film, the prints is, it is lessening in importance for a lot of people. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I guess that's where my mind then eventually ends up is thinking about this death of a physical thing, death of a person, but also death of an object. And so I try to bring it back to life.
I love that. And thank you for doing it. It's beautiful work. And if you haven't already, definitely go to Eli's website. And that website address is, again, Eli?
It's elicraven.com.
Okay, it's easy to remember.
Yeah.
Well, I feel like we should talk a little bit, switch gears just a bit and get into the reason that you're here with us today, you know, which is this residency. I'd like to ask you about residencies and what place they have in your practice and, you know, what attracted you to the idea of a residency in general, like right now in your career?
Well, the thing that attracted me to this residency in particular is that for a number of years, my practice has been really kind of set in this location in my studio, and I get in this way of working, and it left no room for kind of stepping to the side and experimenting, at least at the current time. I feel like I was kind of in I don't want to call it a rut, but definitely in a routine. And so residency was really attractive for me because I could step out of that routine and just really kind of shut down what was happening and try something completely different. And this residency was also really attractive because, you know, I talked a little bit earlier about amassing this collection of found images and found magazines and found books, but I also had binders and boxes full of negatives that came from these families or from archives at a university or whatever. I just had so much of these negatives, and I haven't had time to really properly catalog them, look through them, consider what exists in the negatives, and then even beyond that, they actually sit down and print some of them. So this really gave me the opportunity to like take these and really consider what was in these boxes that I've just been storing for the past 10 years and pull from that archive and create artwork using the darkroom.
Yeah, the Aurora Heron residency is unique in its orientation towards the darkroom. I mean, we look for projects that are going to make special and really excellent use of the fantastic darkroom that is at Heron School of Art and Design. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the Aurora residency is it's 2 weeks of time. It's access to that fantastic darkroom. There's a stipend involved, and lodging is also provided. Thanks to the very generous people here at Tube Factory who donated that lodging. We've just, Aurora Photo Center started that residency just last year with Tara Kranak, who came in. And she did her 2 weeks, she was printing work for her portfolio of the Master Rituals series, and just really enjoyed that 2 weeks in the darkroom. It's amazing to bring artists from far and a little bit closer, in your case, into work in that darkroom because it is such a wonderful, well-stocked facility. And I think it really highlights the value of Indianapolis and Heron School of Art in specific as a place to make work, you know, to come here, take time and make work, be creative. Yeah, so we're very happy to offer that residency. And anybody who's interested in reading more about the residency can go to our website, aurorafoto.org, to read more about that. Yeah, so there's been a lot of interest from the beginning in this particular residency, and we hope to continue it in the future. But, 2 weeks, it sounds, at one point, it sounds like a short amount of time, but also it's kind of a long amount of time, too, to be working with that intensely. I know a lot of different residencies are a whole month. And I don't know. To me, it seems like for, 4 weeks, you might kind of talk yourself into the idea that there might be some days where you could kind of ease off. Mm-hmm. And you know, there's value in that for sure. But, 2 weeks, it seems like to me like the perfect amount of time to just work in extremely intensely. Was that your experience? I mean, do you think that's a good amount of time for a residency? Or?
I think so. I think it was for the purpose of this residency, which was, I proposed this project that I wanted to come in and experiment with this collection and really dig into it and make these works in the darkroom. It was perfect because it goes by in a blink. It went by really fast. But when you're in it, standing, all day long in the darkroom, it can be very exhausting. And so, if it was a month-long residency, I'd probably be thinking about taking a break this weekend. Like, I'm just ready for, just to process what I just did and really kind of look through everything I've put together and also just give my legs a rest.
Yeah, but, don't forget to stretch.
Right? I know, exactly. but it was just the right amount of time, just to get started, to dig in. I really only scratched the surface in my collection, but I really felt like some of the discoveries I made and experiments I made were some were kind of along the lines of things I've done before, but there were some surprises in there. And I feel like they're going to open up some doors to a new way of working, maybe for a body of work, something that can only be done with light. So instead of assemblage covering or distorting or transforming the image, it's transformed through exposure or double exposure, extended exposure. And so that was pretty exciting to see how that worked and how it fits into my practice and can continue.
And that's an idea that came to you before the residency, that you explored during the residency, or did it, was it something that developed while you were here?
Well, I had planned to come in and do some double exposure or just play with, use exposure as a collage technique, basically. Mm-hmm. But I think what really surprised me was just that consideration of just darkness and light as a vehicle for meaning, and how much I was attracted to that, just kind of putting these figures into darkness or pulling them in and out of light felt very like heavy and very meaningful to me. And so I'm going to carry that with me, I think.
Yeah, I noticed that I did have the advantage of looking at some of the work that you've made while you were here up on the board the other day. And one thing that I've noticed about this technique of, you know, combining things with light is that it seems like you're emphasizing the edges of the source material more through this technique. You know, like there seems to be like a more distinct division between the two source materials. I don't know if that's like end product. Is that something that you've decided that is going to be intentionally built into this particular way of working, or maybe that's not something that has that interests you, and it's just something that I observed. I don't know.
No, I think that makes sense. I think there would be more of a connection to the source material because, you know, I'm not adding something totally foreign into the mix. I'm taking a negative, which is made through photography, which is made through light, and then I'm using light on light sensitive paper. And so it feels like, there is a strong connection from the source material to the finished product. Although I was looking over everything today and thinking that like a lot of it just doesn't feel finished to me because I'm so used to taking it one step further and applying other materials and framing. And so it could continue and maybe that'll change, but we'll see.
I was going to ask you about that. Were there seeds that were sort of planted during the residency, you know, after you leave? And it sounds like yes, to answer that question.
Yes, definitely.
Scale is something that I would be interested in relation to the work that you have created while you're here. Just looking at the 8x10s that you've been working with mostly while you've been here, I'm interested to see them larger and see what kind of power or new dynamic that introduces into the work.
Yeah, I feel like I definitely created a number of these experiments in a small scale just to see where things were going. And then what I did this last week in the last few days was just kind of moving up in scale, in playing with some of the images a little bit larger. And I think I'm feeling that they need to be much larger.
Much larger.
At least some of them.
Like how large are we talking here?
I just think that they would be, like a few of them I think would just be much more successful. Like you said, I was working in 8x10s, but an 11x14, 20x24 is kind of the scale range I was able to work in the past, or I chose to work in the past 2 weeks. But I think some of them could be, I don't know, you know, 6 feet tall or something, and just see what that looks like in using kind of the same processes I was using.
Oh, that's exciting. 6 feet tall. That's going to significantly alter the work again, you know, mm-hmm. bring it to a different dimension for sure. Yeah. Wow. So all good things must come to an end. 2 weeks. It's already up. I can't believe it. So you've got some exciting things happening, you know, right after this residency. You are an educator in addition to being an image maker, and school's about ready to start.
Yep, you know, I'm not ready.
I'm sure it's wonderful to have this concentrated time to work on your own work before, you know, going into that other aspect of your practice.
Mm-hmm. And I recently was selected as a finalist in the Fresh 2022 competition at the Klomching Gallery in New York. And so I'll be one of the exhibiting artists there, and that show opens September 15th at Klomching in Brooklyn.
What work are you showing in that exhibition?
That you will see some of the work from my recent work section there. There are just a few works from those first aid projects I talked about.
Which ones?
There's one called Venous Flow. There's a one called Cravat Bondage for the Eye, and that's a portrait with a dangling bandage over a man's head. And one of the corner pieces with the brass reflective sheet. So, it's pretty exciting. It's all the newer work.
How did you come to be selected for that exhibition? Was that did you apply for that, or did they reach out to you?
It was just a call for applicants, almost like a juried competition. Mm-hmm. It was curated. I mean, you could call it juried or curated, but it was curated by the gallery curators, Deborah Klomping and Darren Ching. So
that's in New York City.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, that's very exciting. Oh, my goodness. I love to see work by local regional artists traveling out to the larger dialogue on photography. That's always good to hear.
It's very exciting.
Do you have plans to engage any other residencies? Is that something that you're thinking about already? Is this going to be a regular part of your practice going forward, do you think?
Definitely. I don't have any current plans or applications in process, but I think... I would like to explore different kinds of residencies, maybe even something that's a little bit more cerebral. I felt like I came into this residency with something very clear on my mind, and I just wanted to use this time to get the labor done, really kind of work through it. But I would love to take the time to kind of research my thoughts, get away, and, you know, relax through residency as well. But, you know, I don't know if they exist so clearly, but definitely I think a residency is one of the best ways to really find the time to kind of explore a topic or a project or really get things out. So it will be in regular rotation, I think.
It is the gift of time.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I want to thank you so much for sitting down today and talking about your practice. And I want to thank again the very kind folks here at Tube Factory, Sean Jones and Heron School of Art and Design for their collaboration on this and many other projects.
Yeah. Thank you, everybody at Tube Factory, everybody at Heron. They were all so generous and helpful and welcoming. It was a pleasure.
It's a fun place to make work, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Definitely.
All right. Take care, Eli.
Thank you.